You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation Awards are among the most prestigious science prizes in the world. They're often referred to as the American Nobels. Joining us now are two winners of this year's Lasker Awards, Richard H. Scheller of Genentech in South San Francisco, who got the award for basic medical research, along with Thomas C. Sudhoff of Stanford University for their study of rapid neurotransmitter release, the process that helps drive all brain functions. And another award winner who's with us is Blake Wilson of Duke University, who won the award for clinical medical research, along with Dr. Graham M. Clark of the University of Melbourne in Australia and Dr. Ingeborg Hockmeyer of MedL in Innsbruck, Austria, for their development of the cochlear implant, which, or is it cochlear implant? I think it's cochlear, right?
Either way. Yeah.
Which enables deaf people to hear. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to our show. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you,
Richard,
very much.
Richard, can you first explain the basis of neurotransmission?
I can give it a try. It's probably easiest to think about the peripheral nervous system that is outside your brain at first. And let's try and talk about what happens when you move a muscle, say when you move your finger. There's a signal, an electrical signal, that's sent from a nerve cell in your spinal cord. Nerve cell is called a motor neuron. And the electrical signal travels down a piece of the cell called the axon. When the signal reaches the muscle, the electrical impulse enters a region of the cell called the synapse. And in the synapse, this electrical signal is transformed into a chemical signal. And the chemical is stored in little sacs, maybe like little balloons. And these little balloons burst. And when they burst, they release a chemical that then contacts the muscle cell and causes the muscle to contract.
So they're bursting all the time?
No, they're bursting in a very, very regulated way. If they were bursting all the time, you'd be moving sporadically.
No, but I just
and randomly.
Mean, I mean, I'm just constantly, every time I move, I'm bursting some of these.
Yes, you are.
Sacs.
You absolutely are.
And this all happens very quickly.
Very, very rapidly. Think about how fast someone has to be able to swing a bat, for instance. So a baseball coming in at 100 miles an hour, you have to see the ball, you have to process that through your brain, you have to send the signal down to your spinal cord and out to your muscle. So there are hundreds of synapses involved in that very, very rapid process.
Your research with Thomas Sudhoff identified key molecular participants in neurotransmission. What are they?
Well, these are proteins that actually transform the electrical signal into the signal to burst the little sacs that contain the neurotransmitter and to release the transmitter.
Now, in the past, we thought of it as all being electrical, didn't we? Kind of like what would happen with a computer. When did we start realizing that there was a chemical process involved?
Well, scientists have known that there's a chemical process involved for many, many decades. What was unknown was the mechanism of how the electrical signal was converted into the chemical signal.
What interested you about neurotransmission and led you to devote so many years to studying it?
All students of neuroscience knew about the process of synaptic transmission, of chemical transmission, but none of us knew how it worked, so we wanted to figure that out.
Blake, before we can understand how the cochlear implant works, do we need to know how we hear?
Yes, we did need to know how we hear before we could design a cochlear implant. And the ear is a pea-sized structure filled with 15,000 sensory hair cells, 30,000 neurons, and an exquisite mechanical tuning apparatus that sorts the frequencies of sounds that we hear such that one end of the inner ear is stimulated with high-frequency sounds, and the other end of the inner ear is stimulated with low-frequency sounds. So The inner ear, if you uncoil it, is laid out almost like a piano with the high-pitched notes near the small inner middle ear bones and the low pitches at the other end.
And what is the cochlea? What is its role in hearing?
The cochlea contains all of those structures that I just mentioned. It's a frequency analyzer, and the results of the frequency analysis are sensed by these sensory hair cells. And excitation of the sensory hair cells, in turn, excites the neurons in the auditory nerve.
Well, what are you putting in when you do a cochlear implant?
We're putting in an array of electrodes, between 12 and 22 electrodes, that are designed to stimulate these different sites that are sensitive in normal hearing to different frequencies.
Now, what has happened? Why has the piano stopped doing its job?
The piano stops doing its job because the sensory hair cells are fragile structures, and they can be damaged by loud noises. They can be damaged by a number of genetic disorders. They can be damaged by a number of drug treatments, such as cisplatin, which is used to treat cancer.
What about Q-tips?
Yeah. Well, if you insert them too deeply, you've got a problem. But Q-tips don't ordinarily damage the inner ear.
So we put this thing in to kind of like to revive the things that have been damaged?
Well, the purpose of the cochlear implant is to bypass those damaged sensory hair cells, damaged or missing sensory hair cells, and stimulate the auditory nerve directly with electrical stimulation.
And how well does it restore hearing?
To me, it's a flat miracle how well it restores hearing. It doesn't completely restore hearing, but more than 80% of cochlear implant users today can converse with ease using their cell phones.
And would this be useful for anyone who has a hearing problem? People who have been losing their hearing because they've gotten older or because they have just been putting loud headphones on? Drummers sometimes have to put things over their ears nowadays because they're afraid of losing their hearing, and sometimes they do.
Yes. The range of indications has been broadening as the cochlear implant becomes better and better. Initially, the selection criterion was if a person couldn't hear a jet engine right next to them, then they were a candidate for a cochlear implant. But today, persons with some residual hearing at low frequencies also are candidates for cochlear implants.
Does it work for people who are born deaf?
It does work for people who are born deaf, and it works especially well if they're identified as deaf early in life and treated early in life, while the brain still is able to accommodate a novel input and make large changes in its function so a person can acquire language.
I'm talking with two of the winners of the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation Awards this year, Blake Wilson of Duke University and Richard H. Scheller of Genentech in South San Francisco. Richard, what was known about the process about how neurotransmitters work when you first began your research? You say that they kind of understood it in a hazy way.
People knew that the neurotransmitter was contained in the little balloons that I talked about, and that these little balloons did burst and release the transmitter when the electrical signal entered the connection between nerve and the muscle that we were talking about. But people had no idea of the molecular events that underlie this process.
Has technology enabled you to do some of the work that you've been able to do?
It's all been driven by technology. The technology of modern molecular biology allowed us to purify these tiny little balloons that contain the neurotransmitter and to analyze the molecules on the surface of the balloon.
Are those balloons called vesicles?
Vesicles, synaptic vesicles.
Isn't calcium crucial to this process?
Yes. When the action potential enters the nerve terminal, there are pores on the surface of the cell that undergo a change and open up so that there are little holes in the nerve terminal, and calcium rushes into the nerve terminal, and the calcium ions trigger the bursting of the synaptic vesicle, the release of the neurotransmitter.
But we are told we need calcium, but not too much calcium. Can too much calcium have an impact on this? Or is that too much calcium a problem for other parts of the way the body functions?
It's thought that if too much calcium enters the nerve cell, this can trigger a cell death of the cell, of the nerve.
Does this involve all brain functions? We've been talking about the movement of muscles, but what about forming memories?
Yes, good question. We were talking about moving a muscle because it's easier to explain than the brain. In the brain, there are approximately 10 to the 15th of these synapses, connections now not between nerve and muscle, but connections between nerves and other nerves.
Now, we were talking about the deterioration of some of the things involved in hearing with Blake. What about in this situation? Do we see similar deteriorations?
Well, many of the neurological disorders, such as Alzheimer's disease and so on, are the result of the death of nerve cells and the loss of the specific synapses, the connections between cells. Also, it's believed that the psychiatric disorders are also in some way a malfunction of the connections between nerve cells. Really,
we're talking about schizophrenia, depression,
yes,
bipolar disorder.
Really, all of our thinking, all of our cognition, our consciousness, our ability to think, to remember, to feel, is all a property that emerges from these 10 to the 15th connections between nerve cells, and the process that we now understand of neurotransmitter release is the basis of how the brain works.
What about neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's?
That's a very specific, again, set of nerve cells that degenerate.
So, but all of these things are working in conjunction with other things that are going wrong, I assume.
Yes.
In the end, does one lead to the other? If you're looking at neurotransmitters and thinking about schizophrenia, for example, does that then lead you to other parts of the brain function?
As I said, schizophrenia is certainly a malfunction of the synaptic network, but we don't understand enough about the details yet to know exactly what's going wrong.
And right now there's still a debate over whether it is a chemical thing or something else that causes those kinds of problems.
Whether it's an environmental chemical,
yes,
insult, or whether it's a genetic disease, or whether it's likely a combination of both,
or chemical imbalance,
is still mysterious. It's definitely a chemical imbalance of some kind.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more. We want to talk more about cochlear implants with Dr. Blake Wilson of Duke University. He, along with I'm going to mention the other people who won the award with you when we come back, won their award for the development of the cochlear implant that enables deaf people to hear. Dr. Richard H. Scheller is with Genetech in South San Francisco, and he won the award with Thomas C. Sudhoff of Stanford for their study of rapid neurotransmitter release, the process that helps drive all brain functions. Stay with us for more. And we're back with two recipients of the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation Awards this year, the American Nobels, Richard H. Scheller of Genetech of South San Francisco, for his research into neurotransmitter release, and Blake Wilson of Duke University for his work into cochlear implants. And both of you worked with a number of other doctors, and I wonder about, well, in the case of you, Richard, you're working with somebody at Stanford, so he wasn't all that far off. But Blake, your collaborators on this research, Graham M. Clark is the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Ingeborg Hachmeier, did I pronounce it right? Hachmeier?
Exactly right.
Is in Innsbruck, Austria. So was this research done with the three of you together, or was it all done through email messages? And does the NSA know what's going on here?
I'm not sure about the NSA, but I am sure that the development of the cochlear implant was a worldwide effort that involved multiple research centers in Europe, the United States, Australia, Asia. And the result is the product of all of those efforts by many scientists, engineers, physician scientists, and research subjects.
So you weren't working together, but one of you did something, the other one saw it and said, okay, I'll incorporate that in my work?
Actually, this is a highly cooperative field, and that's one of the powers that propelled us forward, I think. I have worked closely with Ingeborg Hachmeier over the years, and I've worked closely with others at the University of Melbourne. This has been a great privilege.
Didn't many people think it was impossible to restore hearing with electrical stimulation as the cochlear implant does?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, many asserted that it was the height of hubris to think that you could replace the exquisite machinery of the inner ear with just a few crude sites of stimulation. But it turned out that the power of the brain is sufficient to take a sparse and highly distorted input and make sense of it. So really, once we got above a threshold of quality and quantity of information, then the brain could take over and do the rest.
Now, how does this work differently than previous hearing aids, which functioned as kind of like microphones and couldn't discriminate between one sound and another? Does the cochlear implant allow for hearing similar to the hearing I have without an implant?
It comes close to that for the very best patients. And this has been the great surprise, because we only have around 8 effective sites of stimulation in the inner ear with a cochlear implant, but you have 3,500 places in normal hearing that are sensitive to different frequencies. So we wondered whether such a sparse representation could work, and it did. Really, the performance of a cochlear implant is a testament to the brain more than to the designers of the cochlear implant.
The brain wants to do this job well.
It wants to do this job well, and it can learn to do this job well.
Now, I haven't asked you what to describe the cochlear implant and how it's implanted, and listeners want to know.
Well, it's a relatively straightforward surgical procedure for ear surgeons to place a cochlear implant into one of the three main chambers of the inner ear. And it turns out that the anatomy of the inner ear is quite favorable for placement of these electrodes.
Now, the inner ear also sometimes fills up and makes people dizzy. Is this the same place, the part of the ear?
It can be the same place, but more often that's located in the vestibular system, which is the system responsible for balance. And it's immediately adjacent to the inner ear. So some diseases actually affect both structures.
And will the cochlear implant help people who are having problems with balance?
It can help, and it can produce a transient deficit in balance, but that's almost always overcome.
I suspect that you're not completely satisfied with where you are, and you're hoping to go even further. How do you do that?
Well, of course, we hope to go further. Even the very best patients today have difficulties in adverse acoustic environments such as noisy restaurants or workplaces. And perception of sounds that are more complex than speech, like music, are not as satisfying as speech reception. So there's a lot of work underway to close the gap even narrower between artificial hearing and normal hearing.
And that's because the sounds that we get from music are a lot more complicated than the sounds that we get from simple speech?
They're vastly more complicated. Speech probably is driven by evolution such that the 30 or so different speech sounds that we have are very different. So it's easy to determine the differences when you're listening. But music contains all sorts of fine frequency changes and temporal effects, and those are much more subtle and much more complex than speech.
Now, Richard, your work dovetails with Blake's work, doesn't it, to some degree? Because what he's doing then sends the sound to the brain, and we wind up with the neurotransmitters.
Sure. Blake said it's really a testament to the brain. It's a testament to those 10 to the 15th synapses and the way those synapses change based on experience, which encodes our memories or allows the brain to adapt to the cochlear implant versus the normal function.
Now, go ahead.
And supporting that is the observation that speech perception improves for recipients of cochlear implants over time. So they get better and better and better over about a 3 to 6 month period, which is that knitting of the brain that you just referred to.
That's those synapses learning to get better.
Now, are we seeing the same sort of thing in babies as they start perceiving the world?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
babies are forming millions and millions of synapses every day as they learn.
And they're forming them newly so that they can bring in novel information and process novel information far more rapidly and far more completely than adults.
But all of us develop our synapses differently, don't we? Is that one of the reasons we're all different?
In the same way that we look different from each other, our brains think differently from each other. That's just a little harder to relate to.
We have some listeners who have left questions for us. Sarah left this question on our show page. Are there any new developments in helping people with nerve deafness? My daughter has single-sided deafness and wears is it a Baha? A B-A-H-A?
Mm-hmm.
She says it makes a difference, but it is not anything like her two-sided hearing used to be. She has particular trouble in noisy environments, which she'll be exposed to her whole life, of course. Would a cochlear implant help?
Most definitely. There are trials in Europe underway with persons who have single-sided deafness, who have received a cochlear implant in their deaf ear. And the results to date are very encouraging.
Another caller wonders if there's an upper age limit for cochlear implants.
No. Adults receive the same great benefits as younger persons.
Richard, where are you going to take your research now that you have figured out the basic process?
Well, I did a lot of the work at Stanford University, and about a dozen years ago, I moved to a biotechnology company that you've mentioned a couple times called Genentech, and we're very interested in neurological disorders, mostly degenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and so on. So I'd like to take this understanding into helping patients.
Now, this award, I'm sure, will help both of you with funding. But in your case, Richard, you're with Genentech, so they pretty much subsidize your work, don't they? Because they want patents later. I'm going to want my neurotransmitter is going to be.
They do, but
patented this, somewhere down the line.
Of course, every company has a budget, and this, I think, increases my scientific credibility in the eyes of my boss. So this may help with internal funding.
And Blake, I'm assuming this award means a lot to you and your research as well.
Well, of course it does. It brings wonderful attention to the problems of hearing impairments, to the power of biomedical engineering, to the power of the National Institutes of Health that supported my work.
We often hear that fewer people are going to the sciences and fewer people are devoting themselves to the kind of long-term research that you have done in your careers. Is that something that you worry about?
I do worry about it some. However, I think that there are many, many very talented young scientists moving through the university system in the United States and around the world. And those of us that have been scientists were some. I feel as though I was born a scientist. I always wanted to be a scientist, and I never imagined doing anything else.
So you had no choice in the matter.
Absolutely no choice.
We're going to blame that on your neurotransmitters.
Probably appropriate.
Well, there's so many brilliant people in the world, in the sciences and the arts. I'm not worried about the supply.
So we don't have to do anything to get people interested in studying science. Because right now, I guess, one of the reasons education has moved into a lot more testing and thinking along those lines is because of concerns that not enough people were preparing themselves for going into the sciences.
I think the emphasis should be on education because all fields are important, including science.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. I've been speaking with two of the scientists who have won the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation Awards. Should point out that it always seems to be a team that wins them these days. Used to be Albert Einstein alone, and now it's a number of people. Richard Scheller worked with Thomas Sudhoff of Stanford University on his work on neurotransmitter release, and Blake Wilson of Duke worked with Dr. Graham M. Clark of the University of Melbourne in Australia and Dr. Ingeborg Hochmeier of MedEl in Innsbruck, Austria. And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.